All right, I'm going to walk through real quick some of what I've called the guidelines for this forum in the past. And one of them is, a couple of years ago, I declared this a tie-free zone. If you want to do that, I see Steve Curtis and John Gentry have joined me in that. I'm going to declare it a coat-free zone also for a while anyway, unless I get cold, then I'll put it back on. But I'm a little warm at the moment, so don't read anything into that in terms of disrespect, just that I'm a mite warm right here. This is an open forum, which means it's a forum that is open. Audience participation is sought. That doesn't mean that it's unlimited, anybody gets unlimited time, except me, of course, to say whatever's on their mind. And I'm actually going to try to back out and be as non-participatory as I can be, let you have the floor. We're going to try to limit to 1 or 2 minutes, if possible, questions. We have a live mic here. If you come to the mic, we would like you to state your name so that if somebody buys a CD, they'll know who it is that's talking. If you don't forget to do that, we probably won't shoot you, but we would like you to do that. The moderator reserves the right to interrupt, conclude, call on others, change the subject, anything like that. We do not allow harangues. I would prefer no applause or demonstration. If you just feel like a hearty amen, that's okay. But this is not a contest where whoever gets the loudest applause, the most amens, or anything like that wins the contest. Truth Magazine is not the church. Let me repeat that. Truth Magazine is not the church. Does not seek to be the church, never has sought, doesn't want to do it. We would oppose that to a man, I believe, on the board and the staff as strongly as anybody. I don't think anybody not on the staff could have stronger convictions about that than the people who are. But it's always good, perhaps, for us to repeat that. We are not here to determine orthodoxy. I know many of you have heard this before, but we may have people here for the first time, so bear with me for just a moment. We not only don't make it, we don't want to make it. We don't intend to make it. We cannot make it. It is not within our power to do so. We are not gospel guard dogs, despite what some may think. What we do is provide written or oral forums for brethren to discuss various issues that are on their mind and to give reasonable opportunity for response subject to the editor or moderator's discretion. That doesn't mean we're just in here for a giant jam session. We are seeking to find and teach the truth to others. And so if we can, in our interaction, do that, I believe that is a good thing. Now, it is possible, and some people have concerns sometimes, that in a forum like this that things might turn adversarial. It's never done so since I've been moderating it. I don't intend for that to start today. But what I would ask us to do is to take our Bibles, and for just a moment, especially since we don't have the slate on the screen, let's read together two or three passages of Scripture that we all know and that should be second nature to us if we claim to be mature Christians, but sometimes we forget even basic things. In Ephesians, the 4th chapter, if you will, Ephesians chapter 4, I'm reading from the New American Standard, and I read in verse 15, "Speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in all aspects into Him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, being fitted and held together by that which every joint supplies, according to the proper working of each individual part, causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love." If we are part of the body of Christ, then we should behave ourselves as such. And more specifically, if you come now to the end of the chapter, the apostle reminds us, beginning in verse 29, a passage that's sometimes applied to marriage, but it works in other contexts as well. He says, beginning in the 4th chapter, verse 29, "Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you." In perhaps a parallel text in the epistle to the church at Colossae, Colossians chapter 4, we read in that context at verse 6, "Let your speech be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person." That's what we're going to try to do in this forum today, and that is to talk. Now, we have a number of topics. I'll run through them very quickly. That is general categories. I don't really care how, in what order we talk about these or if we talk about them, and we may go wherever, whoever's the next questioner wants us to go. I have received a bunch of questions about the hymnal and other aspects related to that. I may comment upon that later. Brother Matt Basford, who is one of the editors on the review board, and also if you have been paying attention to some of the hymns we've been singing, is the very talented and scripturally oriented author of some of these hymns. Many of the, several of the hymns in the supplement and others as well were written by Matt, and they distinguish themselves, in my opinion, for their strong biblical allusions, sometimes direct quotations from Scripture embedded directly into the verses. Matt may want to say something about that when we get on it. I have several miscellaneous questions. I have one in particular that's going to be a really awkward subject that I'm going to bring up. We have some questions maybe left over from the other day with regard to the foundation, the magazine, attitudes that sometimes talk to themselves. John Gentry wants a word for a moment about a project that he's involved with. I have a kind of a personal survey I'm doing. I'll say a word about. So, let me start with, I'll make a decision here. I'm going to start with what is an awkward subject, and you may not want to talk about it, so we'll get it out of the way immediately, or it may be something you want to talk about. It's awkward because it involves allegations about incidents in a particular congregation. I've disguised that. We are not about telling churches what they ought to do. That is not the purpose of this forum, nor the foundation. It is about, this forum is about, maybe discussing thorny or difficult issues which may be more common than we realize. Several years ago, maybe in the second forum, the issue of pornography came up, for example. And I was amazed at how the conversation and questions just kept going and going and going. And I finally, some of you will remember this, asked without anybody being pressured, could we see a show of hands of people who, in your congregation where you worship, in your family, in your personal circle of acquaintances, how many of you know this to be an issue? And I was amazed at the number of hands that went up. And thus we had, the next year, I think about a 46-page article, Mike, from myself and my wife on this question of pornography, because we confront that in her counseling situations quite a bit. So this may fall in this category. I don't really know. Here's the question. I cannot judge the accuracy of the circumstances. I'm just going to present it as it was presented to me. There are often two sides to a story. But here's the scenario. A family moves into the community and seeks to place membership with a congregation. In that family, there is a family member who is a convicted, registered sex offender. The elders are asked not to share this information with the other members of the congregation. It's a two-part question. One is, what should the elders do? And the second part, if the elders agree not to disclose the information, what should a member who discovers this information do about it? Now, I said I was going to back out of this, but quickly I'll give you my answer to this, and if somebody wants to disagree or add to it, I only think it's not right for the elders to withhold this information in most, and actually I know of at least three churches in which this kind of situation exists, at least where there is a registered somebody who's been convicted of a sex offense and therefore is on the registry in three different states. I suspect it may be more widespread than that. I would answer this question this way. I believe it would not only be wrong for the elders not to disclose that information. I'm not sure in what venue you might want to do that, but it's probably illegal to do it. In some venues, in some places anyway, as I understand the law, this is something that's public information. There's a reason for it being out there. Certainly a Christian can be forgiven. As to the second part of the question, what do you do if the elders enter into an agreement not to disclose that? I don't really know the answer to that question. My natural tendency is maybe to be a whistleblower. But I don't know. So I'm going to open the floor and the mic to anybody who wants to bite on this one, okay? We have any lawyers in the room? I know we have at least one lawyer. Phil, you're not a lawyer, but I'll listen to you anyway.
While preaching in Oregon, there was a individual member of the church that went through this particular circumstance and had finished both his jail time and his court-mandated counseling. I believe it's for Oregon. I don't know about Tennessee law or other laws. Once that takes place and the court allows you to begin mingling back into the general populace, which includes situations where there would be minors. Once it takes place, you go through a process where you have to have an advocate there with you, where you cannot go into private places.
Yes.
Out of the public eye without your advocate. And I was going to be serving along with another member of the congregation as an advocate for individuals. It's a thorny issue because you've got parents and their children.
Yep.
You've got legal obligations.
Yep.
Keeping in mind Romans 13, at least in Oregon, I can't speak for other states, like I said.
Yeah, that's the fourth state that's on my list now. I didn't know about Oregon.
It must be disclosed.
Yeah.
Even after the record reaches the point of culmination of all the stuff that's gone through, in that midtime before it completes, everything is public. Even the employer must know of the situation.
Yeah.
Ethically, as a Christian, it's a difficult setting to be in. Because you're in the midst of everyone's crosshairs and you're trying to help a wounded Christian who's also wounded others. My personal predictions are is that a congregation that's best suited for them, whichever that one may be, needs to be open about it. It's unwise, perhaps, again, on a personal level for that person to go back to where they were.
Yeah.
Without pain there. But you've got to be open to forgiving if you want to be forgiven by God.
It is. And I think we should de-link, and I've already broken my rule, which is you need to come to the mic and state your name. So that was Philip Martin, for the record, if the mic picked it up at all. I think we need to de-link making information available to those who are in a need-to-know circumstance, which certainly would apply, it seems to me, to parents with small children in a congregation, and forgiveness. I mean, certainly a Christian can be forgiven of whatever the sin there is, assuming they are truly penitent and they seek God's forgiveness, and brethren should forgive them as well. That does not mean, to cite a commonly used example, if you have a Christian who has been in your employ and has robbed you, that you need to put them back in charge of the cash register if you reemploy them. They can be forgiven of the crime, but that doesn't mean you have to be gullible about it. So I would say you seem to be agreeing with what I said about the first part of the question. This is, for one thing, it's public information. I mean, in most states, maybe in every state, you can go online and find out. And if it's been a conviction, it's not likely that you're going to be long able to cover that sort of thing up, it seems to me. So that it would be foolhardy to even try to do that in an internet age when information is very, very readily accessible. And another hand over here, would you mind to come to the mic somewhere? I'm going to start enforcing this rule, and then Philip wants a follow-up. If you want to race him to the mic, Phil.
My name is Keith Greer, and I had an incident a couple of years ago in another church in another state where this very thing happened. And I was not aware of it when I held the meeting, but talking to the local preacher at that place afterwards, he shared some information with me. It was very helpful to me personally. The individual who was committed this, it was a crime. He went to jail, spent some time in jail, went through the counseling. When he came to the church that he wanted to work with, he went to the elders himself. He admitted what had happened, told them what he had done, told him what the counseling he had been through, and said that he would submit to anything that they wanted in order to have their congregation and the parents to have no qualms about him being there. He would prescribe to anything that they wanted. And so what the elders determined to do was they had a meeting with him, and they told him, this is how it will be. You will never be in the building alone. There will always be someone with you. We won't allow you to teach in the class where there's mixed men and women. The individual molested a boy, and so they would not allow him to teach. But at the same time, they would allow him to do anything else. He had repented. He had corrected his mistake. and they let the congregation know that they had talked to him, what the situation was, and I was there, and I did not see him after I had this conversation with the local preacher. I did not see him treated in any different way. I did not see any problem. It was a large group, about 150 people, and he moved in and out. He was never alone. He was always with somebody. But the thing that really helped me is his willingness to do whatever it took in order to put everybody's mind at rest. And I believe that obligates us closely, as I can read in the Bible, to be forgiving. Now, in the state that I live in presently, from what I've been able to read and understand, that information would have to be known. You would make yourself liable.
Yes.
If something would happen and you did not take
yes.
any precautions to prevent that from happening to someone else, there are legal ramp. Now, I understand there's a separation of church and state, but there's also legal ramification for the church. If something is not done and an incident happens, the first person they're going to come and question is, did you know about this and did you take any precautions? I felt that what they did in this other state, that was something I thought was best for both things to be protected, the people in the congregation and the person who wanted to do the right thing.
Okay, thank you. Phil, where you're coming to the mic, if you want to follow up, I'll say that, I mean, that is a much healthier situation, both in the sense that nobody's trying to cover anything up. I understand why a family might want to keep information like this from the public, but A, you can't do it. B, there are legal liability issues. C, it's much easier to forgive when it's open like that. 1 second, Phil, and I'll tell you one congregation where I was in a meeting this happened. Not only did they have all of the arrangements that you had, I don't know in what part of the process this gentleman was, but he's a very, very charming, delightful gentleman, which may be part of the problem, but he's very, you know, you wouldn't suspect anything like this just sitting at a dinner table with him. But when he came to dinner, he was invited to dinner at the local preacher's house, and by law, the preacher had to remove his minor children from the residence. He had to arrange for them to be somewhere else during the time that this brother was sitting at his dinner table with a visiting preacher and some other people from the congregation in order to be legal in that state. And I understand that that regulation is not limited to a single state. I don't know the law in every state, obviously. Bill?
Yeah, I was going to say my name is Corey Willis, since Corey's out of town, but I'm sure Corey would like that. A few other things to keep in mind. The incidences of people being registered as sex offenders is only going to grow as they expand the various aspects of the sex offender laws. I deal a lot with the law enforcement community, partly as a hobby, but partly because I've got a lot of friends who do that particular job, and they're expanding a lot of the aspects of what's going to be classified as a sex offense that will require registration in various states. And the laws keep changing and are ever increasing, where you have people who are registered sex offenders that 20 years ago, the problems would have been sinful conduct only. It would have been two young minors who had relations. But now both of them will be registered as offenders in some states. And by law, a lot of those things have to be made known. They have to be registered on state sex offender registries. Whenever they go into large public facilities, leadership of those facilities, whether it's a church or a YMCA or a gym or whatever, have different degrees of obligation. And to the second half of that question, there is a legal requirement. The bottom line is, if something happens, you will get sued. That seems to be the standard rule of thumb from all the people I'm talking to about these kind of things. And the people who get sued the most are those who have the biggest pockets. And in a church setting, unless there's a very wealthy member who's an elder, it's going to be the church with your liability insurance. That means the elders are going to be called to account, or those who are trustees for the local congregation. And so, while there may be some settings and situations where the confidence can be kept about sinful conduct amongst individuals and Christians, and there's value to that, once you move into the criminal realm, it's a whole different setting. There's a different level of legal obligation that has to be held up to, and you're setting yourself up for failure by getting into those backroom deals. It's just as if Israel made those deals with the nations going into Canaan. It's the wrong kind of deal to make. You're setting yourself up for failure that way. One other thing about Oregon settings, this is another impact of that circumstance. When you do what I believe is the right thing and try to create an environment where a Christian can worship, there are going to be those who are uncomfortable with that decision. Parents, young people. Keeping it closed just makes the problem fester and get worse. The problem's going to come up. They're going to find out about it one way or the other. Someone will talk. You know, the way to keep a secret is not tell anybody. That's why a lot of the pranks they did at Florida College are unknown, because I'm the only one who knows about them. And with that perspective of keeping things in that kind of ideal, telling them ahead of time lets you deal with the problem on your terms. It lets you teach through the problem rather than they've blown up, they're freaking out because a registered sex offender is sitting next to their child in services. I mean, you have to get to that little literal sense of things. I know that in that circumstance, it really troubled members of multiple congregations as this fellow tried to figure out where he needed to worship. One other thing in Oregon, at that time, it's changed now some. Once the second phase of their release, which is after the counseling but before the judge signed a final release, their names can actually be taken off that registry depending upon their particular infraction. It depends on how long they stay on that list.
Let me make one other comment, and then we can move on unless somebody else wants to. It seems to me from a spiritual standpoint, and as somebody who's been an elder for a decade now, if my job is to watch for souls in the congregation, I can only imagine how betrayed a family would feel and how much I would feel I had not done due diligence and not performed my God-given duty to watch for the souls in this flock. If I hid the fact, not that this person has done some unforgivable sin, but that they have indeed committed a sin which puts at risk giving the relatively high rate of repeat offense in this particular set of crimes, I don't see how I could be doing my job as an elder, to get to the second part of this, by not disclosing and indeed by entering it into an agreement to hide this information. I would be difficult for me to face either the Lord in judgment or families who might, because of my lack of due diligence, be exposed then to potential horrendous behavior. Those two things seem rather incompatible to me, in addition to all of the legal and other kinds of issues that we've raised. All right, anybody else want to comment on this particular thing? I said we do have one attorney present. I don't know if you wish to identify yourself and comment. If so, speak now or forever hold your peace. All right, let's move on. I was given a question just a little while ago, and it actually touches on something. So I'm going to let some of these young guys have a crack at this one because it's been discussed on a Bible study list. We recently had the opportunity as a church to help some needy saints who lost their home in the floods. We agreed to send them money from the treasury. But the church building where they attend was also badly damaged. We desired as a church to send to the aid of the other church out of our treasury. Someone objected, saying we have no authority to send from our treasury to theirs. Can a church do this? And if so, what is the passage that provides authority? Well, that's been the subject of some discussion. So any list members want to come up and address this particular question? Or anybody else? As I read the question, that was what the proposal was. I was about to turn to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. I mean, count correctly, I think there are 9 passages in the New Testament where you do have, in the case of a needy, unequal church. Paul uses the term equality in 2 Corinthians 8, which obviously doesn't mean that everybody has to have the same kind of building, the same number, but they're not able to meet their own basic needs. They cannot care for their own members. And if a church has an abundance, there are instances where that happened. I would need to know, I guess, more about the particular circumstances of this particular instance to know that. A complicating factor for me would be the existence of church property. Clearly, it seems to me, a church can support needy saints in times of need. If there is church property in which equity could be accessed, does that make the receiving church truly a needy church? I don't know enough detail about this circumstance to know the answer to that question. Anybody else want to take it? Mike Willis has got his Bible open. Mike, what do you think? You need to come to the mic, Mike.
Are we talking about helping them reconstruct the building?
Well, I think both. Let's start first with the members. Again, the last sentence says they're badly damaged church building. I think the real question is, can you send to the aid of the Christians in the other church? Let's deal with that issue first, and then we'll get to the church building issue.
Well, it looks like you have churches helping each other in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 when Paul gathered funds from a variety of churches to take to the brethren at Jerusalem. And you have, at least I've interpreted Acts 11, 27 through 30, where that you had collections delivered to the elders of the church at Jerusalem there. And I would also just talk about an experience, if I can, about this.
Testify, brother.
We had a incident in our area where that a man was involved in an automobile accident and lingered for about a month before passing away. And funds were sent to him directly. And the hearts of the people poured out so much that there was a large amount of money left over after all the bills were paid. And it created some real issues among the brethren because of that, looking like they just set the family up, you know, rather than that. And if it had been sent to an eldership that was overseeing the thing, that would not have happened. So there are some judgment issues that have to be dealt with in this. So I think it's always cautious to have the local church involved in that. But sometimes local churches themselves do not act quickly enough, and you might be forced to have to deal with another aspect of that issue in that case. So, first of all, yes, there's Bible example of one church helping another one in a benevolent situation. And secondly, there's some judgment issues that have to be addressed.
Yes, that's right. And even in a case of even internally in a congregation, or whether it's a one church sending to another for the relief of the members in that congregation, there are many forms of relief in our modern culture anyway, where there are lots of funds, and this is going to come off sounding cold and hard-hearted, probably, but I would want to know more detail about this particular circumstance. Or I know of an instance where a church had an issue of a family lost their business in a bankruptcy proceeding and came to the church asking, "We are now needy, and can you help?" But they're living in a house that's worth several times what many other members were living in, and still had some rather still had assets that could have been used, is the point. So I think it's next to impossible to address every issue without more knowledge of detail. I see your hand, Tom. John Gentry's walked up here. Do you want to? Okay, all right. Yeah, and I would argue in that passage it's not altogether clear to me that that's church action to start with, but that's another, I mean, necessarily, it could be, I think, from the language of Acts 11, I don't know that it necessarily implies that, but Mike may want to correct me from the Greek here. John.
My name is Jesse Flowers. No. Some of the passages, there are the nine, or if you just want to combine, or 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, there are eight of them. But as we think about this question, the question that we have been discussing on the list is, what is the pattern? What is God's plan for us in the realm of benevolence? And I think Mike hit on something there, even from Acts chapter 11. Two very fascinating things about that particular passage. It appears that is individual collections that have been sent to the elders of the churches in Judea at that particular time. But another fascinating thing about it is that the churches in Judea had not requested that they send relief to them. It was something that was prophesied by Agabus that there would be a famine coming. And so when they heard that, the individual disciples collected money and sent it to the elders of these churches. We really only have two examples of the relief of benevolent needs in the New Testament. One is the Acts 11 example, and the other seven or eight passages comprise the other example, with the church in Jerusalem that I guess Mike got mixed up there. And in that situation, it is apparent from Acts chapter 20, when Paul arrived in Jerusalem, and the messengers that had been appointed by the men from 1 Corinthians chapter 16, there in verses 3 and 4, Paul talks about these churches appointing their own messengers, that those people were with Paul when he arrived in Jerusalem, and that the very first thing they did is all of them together met with the elders. Now, if you want to call it a forced conclusion, that's fine. If you don't think it's a forced conclusion, that's fine too. But those people who were messengers with Paul, they met with the elders in Jerusalem. That was the very first thing that they did, carrying the money, carrying the benevolent needs from the various churches that we see being discussed, and actually helping this particular benevolent need. Now, what I gather from both of those examples is that when there is benevolent need, especially being sent by a congregation to another area, we can be confident in the pattern that we send it to the elders. And the elders address those situations. The elders know how to handle those situations, and the situation that Mike mentioned. All the questions about what to do with these things could be much easier to address. The question becomes about churches sending money to individual Christians and other places for benevolent needs. And at this point in our discussion on the list that Steve mentioned, we haven't been able to come up with a passage that we can confidently say authorizes the church treasury in one church to send relief directly to individual needy saints in another location. And this has come up with Katrina, it's come up with the flooding now, comes up often with the Philippines. How do we go about handling some of those things? I think from passages such as Ephesians 4 and verse 28 and others, we know that individual Christians can send to other individual Christians that are in need. But part of the question that was asked deals with churches sending to other needy people. And again, I think we can safely say that yes, we can send it to the elders of other congregations and let that be handled in that way. With the other, I don't think you can put your finger on the passage that authorizes another form of relieving needy saints from a church's treasury. But again, that's part of what's being discussed.
Okay, let me say first, the moderator apologizes. I didn't catch whatever slip Mike might have made, if in fact he made one. Mike, do you want equal time to respond?
No. Yeah.
And Tom raises a valid point. I mean, in Acts 11:27, they sent it to the elders, not specified. They in 12:25, after this big interlude where you have the arrest of Peter and the death of Herod, it says they returned from Jerusalem. It specifies that. But as was pointed out in the institutional controversy by a number of people, there are five. A record of five visits that Paul makes to Jerusalem in the book of Acts. And one way of weaving together the tapestry, the backdrop of the New Testament, when Paul changed from being unknown by face to the churches of Judea, Galatians chapter 1, at one point he was not known, at another point he is known. When could that have happened? And if you read those five accounts, it seems to me that this is the only recorded instance anyway in which that could have happened, the idea being that Paul became known by face to these churches as he went around and distributed to the elders, not at Jerusalem, but of each of these congregations in Judea. If that's not the time that he changed his condition from being unknown by face to being known, then I don't know where it is. Maybe there's one that's unrecorded, but as far as recorded visits, that's the only one that the time that could conceivably have occurred. Now, I don't know if that clarifies the water or muddies it or whatever, but I'm ready for somebody else to talk. Who's it going to be? Anybody? Well, okay. We can move on. And Bobby Holmes.
There were two distinct needs. One was in AD 48, about 48, the other was AD 50-something. So the need in Acts 11 is the same from the need of 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 and Romans chapter 15.
All right. Any other comment on this topic? I've got another question that was handed to me, and I appreciate people being thoughtful enough to prepare questions. This is actually one that we have discussed before, maybe twice in the last 5 years, and it does tap into some questions perhaps from the forum on Tuesday, and that may be where we wind up going with this. But two specific questions. My niece was withdrawn from recently. What should be my response toward her? Should I withdraw as well? Secondly, her husband says we are judging them in attending an instrumental church. I assume that means that the niece and her husband are attending there. He used passages like Romans 14 and ones he said were against disputing and debating. How would you answer? I'm presuming Romans 1:29 may be the text in question, although this does not say that. I guess my answer to the second question would be you try to teach such individuals until such time as it becomes clear that they are. I mean, if somebody is at least trying to give a scriptural answer for behavior, they're at least looking at the Bible to say, here is a text which either authorizes or possibly condemns a certain behavior. It seems to me you have to at least for a certain period of time salute at least the attempt to be biblical. Now, we all know that there are, or at least many of us have had experiences, where somebody who's citing a text, trying to use the Bible, is literally doing that. They're using Scripture as a ploy, so to speak, as a pretext to make a passage say something that it doesn't really say. There are all kinds of examples of this sort of thing in overseas work. You get people sometimes in China or Eastern Europe, for example, they want to have a Bible study, and usually it only takes a lesson or three to determine, are they really sincerely wanting to study the Bible, or are they simply using that as a reason to practice their English, which is a desired skill in some of these cultures. So I think you have to start out taking such things seriously, as long as it's not clear that it is just simply a ploy. Now, as to how far a family member goes in observing a withdrawal, again, that gets into a sort of, I can't maybe answer that until I know more details about the circumstances. Are they members of the same congregation? If they're not, am I obligated as a Christian who is a member of one congregation under the oversight of those elders to honor the desires and statements of another congregation, which maybe I know or believe to be erroneous? Maybe I believe they were falsely or unfairly withdrawn from. I'd like more information to be able to answer that question. As a general rule, if someone has been withdrawn from, unless it just appears to be a total fabrication, Christians cannot afford to give aid, comfort, and approval to those who are misbehaving or behaving badly, who are not behaving as Christians should. And so while, again, doing due diligence to try to discover as best one can, is this a legitimate case? If they've been withdrawn from, then I cannot lend approval or put my stamp of approval upon someone's behavior that way, even if they are a family member. That seems to me to be a rule that, you know, could be derived from any number of passages. Now, somebody wants to argue with that, I will try to hold up my end of the conversation. All right, Ron, come argue with me. We used to do this a lot.
We've touched on things in this lectureship that involve judgment areas and then things that we all know are directly legislated. And so we have to try to meet this challenge of balancing those things properly. One that's generally recognized among all our brethren, that we're commanded to attend all the services of the church. That's pretty obvious from the different passages. You have other passages that command us to feed our family, provide our needs, etc. You could multiply that list of passages. And brethren, with rare exceptions, in my 45 years of preaching, have recognized that there's an area of judgment there as to what kind of work can you take that impinges on your attendance and to what degree and how many services. And I don't know the answer to that. I've never tried to make a formula to answer that in a concrete way. I have to leave that between the individual and God. Is he, as Steve was implying there, that you could play with things like this because you're trying to dodge a responsibility. Well, if they do that, God knows that. But beyond what God knows, all I know is what the person says. I'm trying to be faithful in attendance. I'm trying to feed my family. And so how many services, I don't know. You can make it obvious it's out of balance either way. Now, if I apply that principle to a lot of other Bible subjects, it helps me in some ways, and this is one of the ones, not to eat, not to have social occasions with people withdrawn from. The Bible equally is commanding to fulfill family responsibilities. In other words, I don't have the same relationship, Steve, here that I have to my wife, if my wife was withdrawn from and if Steve was withdrawn from. There is a difference in that, not because the Bible is making a different pattern of discipline. The point is there's more than one principle that applies to what you're talking about. And if more than one principle applies, you've got to pay respects to both principles. And so there would be things I might do with my wife. There definitely would be things I would. But I would not regard that as social activities. Inviting Steve to go out with me for an all-day fishing trip would be a social matter.
Not likely to happen.
Spending time with my wife doing any number of things, even if she was withdrawn from, that's not a social matter at all. That's a family obligation. And I know, because I've had discussions before, it offends some brethren when you say things like that. Oh, you don't believe 1 Corinthians 5 just because it's your family. No, that's not the point. I'd believe 1 Corinthians 5. But I'm saying we believe Hebrews 10:25, don't we? Yes. We believe 1 Timothy 5:8. You either make a living for your family or you're worse than an infidel. So you have to balance the two. Now, what's the perfect formula to balance it? I don't know. I believe you need to be sincere about what you're doing, and God knows the ultimate answer to that. And so I would apply that same thing here. I don't know how to give the exact formula to some of this.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, I know of instances where people absent themselves from the Sunday night, Wednesday night services of the church, claiming that in one case that they don't believe in Bible classes, which in the case I'm thinking of was a fairly recent conviction. Of course, that has not always been a part of their understanding of the Bible, and at least where I worship, we don't have Sunday night Bible classes, so it seems like that reason for not being present would not apply in that case. And that's correct. You have to, I mean, when I say it, at some point it may become clear, not because we're judging motives, but because by their fruits you shall know them. Sometimes it is possible for, not only for God to know what truly is in the heart, but sometimes people's activities betray what their real thinking is. But until we get to that point, or believe that we're there, it seems to me that we have to follow the procedure that Ron is describing here. All right. Keith, you want to come enlighten us at the microphone, please? That's probably also not likely to happen this afternoon.
I've struggled with this issue all my life. And if you could help me, I would be more than appreciative. I have a father who has been out of duty for 32 years. He's growing older, and now I'm at the point in my life where things that I would not do earlier, now I find myself trying to spend more time with him because I'm afraid that my time is running out. But at the same time, I feel the weight of being a gospel preacher. I know what I stand in that pulpit, and I know what I preach. I know what I believe. And I want to be consistent. I don't want to make a distinction because it's my father. But at the same time, I feel some of the things that Ron says. I have a responsibility as a son. He is my father. He's the only one I'm going to have. He's going to be here for a limited number of time. And so I have to weigh, what do I do? Do I violate 1 Corinthians chapter 5 if I go out on that fishing trip? It's just me and him. And I can sit down. And I'm just going to tell you how I've reckoned this out. What I have done is I involve these decisions with me. I don't include my wife. I don't include anyone else. I just include me. If I'm doing the wrong thing, then it just affects me. But if you could give me some leeway, I'd be more than happy to think of something I'm not thinking about. My first responsibility to him is his soul. I want him to be saved more than I want to have a physical relationship with him. But at the same time, to do that, I'm going to have to be around him. So where, how do you judge? How do you know when you're doing what's right and when you're making an exception because it's your family, because it's your family member? I've been on both sides of this. I've been accused of being unloving. I've been accused of making an exception because it's someone in my family. Now, I think I know my heart and I know what I'm trying to do. But again, I want to be consistent. Does it make me a hypocrite to stand and preach 1 Corinthians 5 that you have to have nothing to do the way I've always understood it? I have a different relationship with my father than you do. I would not include my... Let me give you an example. My father loves to fish. It's been one of his passions. Now, my son, he is, for a lot of other reasons that I won't go into here, is not a Christian. Now, he spends time with his grandfather. He wants to spend time with his father. Okay, I go. Me, him, and my son. Am I violating the principle established in 1 Corinthians 5? There was a time I wouldn't go. Now, I'm looking at that much differently because of his age, because of my opportunities. I know God's word doesn't change. If you could help me see my responsibility, I'd be more than grateful.
Anybody want to help our brother here? Bobby, would you come to the mic, please? I'm relatively certain that many of us here, I'm one of them, have similar or family circumstances that are not that different from what Keith is describing. And I may comment in a minute, but I'm going to let Bobby have first turn here.
As Ron has stated, there are responsibilities we have toward our family. We must understand, I'll give you an example. We had a granddaughter at one occasion that left the faith. I was serving as an elder, one of the elders, as in the congregation where she was a member. It reached a point where we had to withdraw fellowship from her. And I requested of the elders to let me make the announcement because I didn't want anyone thinking that I was not supporting it. She later was restored to the faith. You don't outguess God's order of things. But there are things in a family unit, husband, wife, and children at home, that are far different than other members. Now, if I understood the question right, there was a niece that was withdrawn from. Can I fellowship her? Now, I'm firmly convinced that in a husband, wife, children at home relationship, that it's not the same. We have certain obligations to our wife or husband who may have been withdrawn from. That have nothing to do with the order of don't even eat with them. If my wife was withdrawn from, could she cook a meal for me and we eat together, or must we eat separately? Or could we cohabit? There are so many things involved in a marriage that God expects of us. If our children that are still at home, one of them should be withdrawn from, can we allow them to remain there? We'll kick them out. I'm not trying to give our brother a leeway against what God says. But Scripture says that if one is withdrawn from, if I understand it correctly, we're not to count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. Now, here again, there are some matters of liberties. There's some matter of judgment that must be taken into consideration. It's a known fact, and I'm not, and I'm saying this, I'm not intending to allow something that God does not allow, but it's a known fact, I'm told. I don't get to go that often, though I love to fish. But it's a known fact, I'm told, that fishing, you have an opportunity to talk to people that in other conditions you'd never be able to. I don't know of a better situation that to talk to someone about their soul than out fishing in a boat. I mean, you got a captive audience. They either jump out and swim or Or they sit there and listen.
Take them up in a Cardinal RG. That probably worked. Take them up in a Cardinal RG or some small plane. That works too.
Yeah, well, but these are matters of judgment. As I look at it, I could not see that it would be a violation of 1 Corinthians 5 if I went with my father fishing. If I'm intent upon, and I would have to do this because I believe I would have to because God says so. If I do so with the intent of spending at least a portion of that time admonishing him to change his life. Now, if I just go out for a social fishing trip and I'm not going to mention spiritual situation, then I believe I would be violating it. But we have to maintain a relationship with people. That's what Paul is talking about when he said, don't count him as an enemy. You know, you don't cut him off and say, I'm not going to speak to you anymore and go to the other side of the street if you see him walking down the street. No, we admonish him as a brother. We don't count him as an enemy. We admonish him as a brother. These are things that we need to think about when we talk about withdrawing fellowship. I also had a daughter-in-law that at another time that became, in fact, she got involved in immorality and ended up, my son had to divorce her. She left the children. We had to withdraw fellowship from her. And again, I ask, let me make the announcement. Family relationship. I said the other day, I'm nobody's man. I'm not. I serve the Lord. And so it doesn't make any difference. I will draw the line where God draws the line. And if we all love the Lord, we'll do the same thing.
Okay. That's a little more than 2 minutes. Anybody else want to speak on this? All right. Come, brother, and then Philip next. And I've got something that'll broaden the horizons of the discussion maybe a little bit even wider. Maybe.
There's probably a lot of us that have these kinds of situations in our lives.
Could you identify yourself, please? For
Tom Mitchell, Blackfoot, Idaho. And there's two things that I've heard mentioned that we dare not lose sight of. First of all, the withdrawal is for the purpose of causing them to wake up to their problem. And so we dare not lose sight of that. As far as the responsibilities that we have to our family members, there are those responsibilities as well. And they include physical things. We have a responsibility to everyone as far as spiritual things. And so what we do with our family members, if they have a need and it's our responsibility to help them, then that becomes our responsibility. If we have the ability to help them, that's our responsibility. But we dare not lose track of that. If, as Brother Keith has mentioned, his father's getting older and he wants to spend some time with him, and then Brother Bobby mentioned that that's a good time to talk to him when he's fishing. That's an excellent opportunity to do that very thing that you have a responsibility to do. But to simply go out there to satisfy your desire to be with him, I'm not sure that the Scriptures allows that. And so we dare not lose track of the responsibilities that we have, whether they be physical or spiritual.
All right, Philip, if you want to come on up here, let me just broaden this a little bit. I have a personal situation. I'd appreciate insight. It's not a case of withdrawal, but I have a very dear family member who has not been withdrawn from, but is a member of a congregation that practices things that I don't believe are biblical or scriptural. And when we have talked in the past, for several years, every conversation we have, we're separated by 2/3 of a continent, so we don't see each other that much, but even on the telephone, I made it a point to bring up some of these differences and to try to force a conversation. And finally, it got to the point that we just about quit having conversations. So my mantra again is, you have zero influence over somebody you're not talking to. And what I finally said to this person is, I don't feel compelled. I've said everything I know to say. I've done every kind of teaching I know to teach on this subject. They know what I believe about it, why I have reservations and concerns that would keep me from worshiping with them, even though it's not a withdrawal situation. And so where I am right now, as I've said to them, if I feel like I need to talk about this, I'm going to talk about it. This cannot be the only subject in the world that we never talk about. but I don't feel compelled to turn every conversation in that direction. If there's an opening, fine. And there will be more because, as has been described, we're going to be thrown together more as our aged parents grow older and decisions have to be made about time spent with them. So how do these principles apply where it isn't a case of someone having been withdrawn from, but maybe practicing something that, I mean, they go to church every Sunday, they do all kinds of things. Philip, and then Brother Ligon.
Well, I'm not smart enough to answer Steve's question. So
please.
So I'll handle that one. Tom Mitchell touched on some of the things I was going to address, and it puts together in my mind, I struggle with this somewhat and have in the past. You know, on my wife's side, there's some members of her family who are justifiably been withdrawn from and justifiably should have been withdrawn from in various settings. And it's difficult navigating all those family relationships and yet still trying to get the right message into the right hands. And the principle that has to be balanced along with the obligations to family, the obligations to discipline, is the idea of providing the right opportunity to do so. Christians ought to be minded towards service. And one of the best ways that I can think of to help, because Brother Gray had a very specific question, is to figure out how to accommodate the spiritual needs of his father and maybe to another extent his son as well, is to look in that realm. Look towards avenues where they can be served. You're no longer violating what might be your conscience in regards to the social settings of the fishing trips, which might be excellent. I don't know. I can't make that judgment for someone else. But see now, but there are areas of their lives that they need help with, physical as well as spiritual. Make that dual purpose be able to work itself through. So you're serving God's goal of discipline. They understand that. You're serving God's goal of your service because you're helping them. You're not providing a poor example by providing the image of being one who just gives in to the social whims of family members. You end up providing the great example of saying, I'm somebody who serves someone who has a need. When the need goes away, you look for a new need, whether it might be they're ill. Okay, you're there at their side right away. Or perhaps you know the roof is needing to be cleaned out or whatever it is. You get them there, you're doing your responsibilities that you ought to. You're developing your character, but you're also using judgment. You get to be in the driver's seat. You get to pick the location. When you're going along on the ride, whether it be to the fishing trip or whatever, you've lost your ability to control the environment. You're no longer in charge of when, where, how, and who. And so my preference in trying to balance those principles has always been trying to be the driver, be the one who picks the place and picks the time. You check your ground out ahead of time so that you can wage a better conflict because you're battling for their soul. It's not just a, hey, how you doing? I love you. It's, hey, how you doing? Let's help you overcome whatever's dragging you down.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have an answer for the other one.
He's been waiting patiently. We'll let him have the mic for a while, Rick.
My name is Rick Ligon. I was just wondering if a part of our problem may be the fact that we're not exactly using exactly right terminology, maybe.
Could be.
From the standpoint that I'm not sure that the Bible actually talks about the idea of withdrawing fellowship so much as it just talks about withdrawing ourselves. And the idea that obviously the brethren in 1 Corinthians 5 were withdrawing themselves. They were no longer having association, not having company with that person in terms of social things. But that evidently didn't mean that they weren't involved with them at all, because obviously you can't have zero influence if there's no relationship at all. So does one being with somebody, does that have to be equal social association? I can be with somebody trying to help them, try to talk to them about their soul. Our relationship is considerably different now because this brother has been withdrawn from in the congregation that I'm a part of, certainly, and maybe withdrawn from by some other congregation, and so our relationship is different. But that doesn't, and so I might be with him, but does that mean that I necessarily have to be with him for social reasons? And so I don't know. I wonder sometimes when the brother said something about how can I be with him if I can't socialize with him? Well, I'm not sure that your being with him necessarily has to equate to socialization or being social with him. Obviously, I think our relationship has to change, and obviously there are relationships that and requirements in certain relationships that we have to meet those requirements. My concern for the brother is not so much the fact that you know, I want to be with him because I'm afraid I'm not going to have an opportunity to be with him very long. My concern is, what responsibility do I have to him as a son to a father who's aging? And I think I certainly would have some responsibilities that would require me to be around him and to be with him and to help him in those things. And that wouldn't necessarily be the same thing as having social association or withdrawing that association as described in 1 Corinthians 5.
Well, I'm not sure we not only don't have a terminology project, but we may be talking past each other in the sense that, I mean, you could use a purely social, or what might be seen by others as a purely social occasion, to turn that into a spiritual discussion. I mean, just as Jesus with the woman in John chapter 4 very easily turns a conversation about a normal topic into a spiritual discussion. So social and spiritual may be, in this context, in the eye of the beholder, or maybe have to judge on a case-by-case basis.